Thank you, Mr. Downing. It's a real joy to be here and share with you today what the Lord has done in our lives. As I was saying to one of the girls as we walked down the hall, during those years of internment, I thanked the Lord many times that Paul, under the anointing and moving of the Holy Spirit, took time to sit down and write his experiences. And God gives you every experience so that you might share it with someone else. Only the things that really become meaningful and real in your lives are the things that you share with others. We were opening our new area this past term on the field. We had wanted to go up into this area since 1955, since we first arrived in the Baleen Valley, or Cannibal Valley as it's now called. And I wanted to go with Jerry because I realized what a tremendous difference it made when there was a woman in the party. But the last time anyone had been in this area was a government patrol, and our people sit in the long grass because they want to see you, they want to know how many of you there are, they want to get a look at you and see if they might have known you before, and so they're always hidden in the long grass. And then at a given signal from someone, they feel that they know enough about you, and so they rise up and make themselves known. And these government people had only been a short time in the valley, and very often they are not there long enough to learn the language of the people, to really know the people, and so they aren't really equipped to meet the people. And so they had come up into this area, and immediately the people, after they had seen how many of them there were, and what they had on as clothing and where they might have come from and so forth, they just suddenly raised up out of that long grass all around those people, and they panicked and they turned around and grabbed their guns and started to shoot. And they killed the head man of this area. Nobody had been up in this area since then. The government didn't dare to go up there. The police wouldn't go. And so we felt that God was very definitely leading us to this area. We had known it since 1955. And so now finally the time had come for us to go. We had gone down one other time, but before we could get enough people to give us their permission to help go on through their area, and it was already dark, we couldn't get to this area. And so we had to turn around and come back, and this time I was going up again with Jerry. And this morning I was leaving my two little boys. Both of my boys were born in America, and when they were just a few months old, I took them out, and so they grew up in New Guinea. That's home to them. And they're looking forward, just like their mother and father are, to going home again. And so I knew I couldn't take the babies with me because I couldn't get across the battlefield and over the no man's land with them in time to find a place where we could spend the night. Because there's a large area there, which is no man's land. The whole valley is broken up into fighting groups. And so the people downstream can fight those across the river and upstream and downstream from them and never fight the same people. You say, why do you fight these people? We don't know. Our fathers fought them. Their fathers fought them. They're just our enemies. You have to fight them. And they couldn't really tell you why they fought those people. And so across this battlefield, we had to go, and it was quite a distance. And so I felt maybe I should leave the children behind. And then Mrs. Maxey, as I was beginning to pray about it, Mrs. Maxey said to me, darling, you leave them here with me. Let me take care of the boys. And so it was agreed. And this morning as I went up to take the children and their clothing to Shirley's house, I put the little boys down and I turned around and I looked at them and I realized our boys are all boy and they're 100% in the flesh. And I realized Mrs. Maxey had her own two children, and I thought maybe I was imposing on her to leave my two with her. And evidently Shirley read the thoughts of my mind because she smiled and she said, darling, don't worry about a thing. You know, I believed her. I walked out of that door and pulled the door shut, and I left all my anxiety concerning those boys and even Shirley behind me. As I walked down the trail that morning, the Lord said to me, my child, how many times have I said the very same things to you? Don't worry about a thing. Yet you haven't really believed me. You see, it's in the scriptures. says, don't worry about a thing. I know those aren't the words in which the verse is clothed, but that's exactly what it says. Philippians 4:6, be anxious for nothing. How many anxious cares did you bring here this time? I've seen something of the anxiety of young people these days. Anxious? Anxious that they're going to do a good job? Anxious, concerned about being accepted? Anxious about tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow? Anxious about whether they're going to have sufficient? Listen to him this morning, young people. The only one who can back up his words 100% says to your heart this morning, don't worry about a thing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I learned a wonderful lesson that day. You see, sometimes you could have anxious fears in your own heart as to how you're going to be accepted by your people. I remember the time when I went over the trail and into the interior the first time before the war. I realized after we'd been on the trail for a few days and that we had to make a certain number of miles every day or we just weren't going to make it to these bivouacs along the way, and they were just crude lean-tos. We'd cut down the long grass, throw a tarp over them. That's how we slept at night. Every night's rest on that trail was marked by the graves of the men that didn't make it. And yet I knew that God, by his appointment and directive will, had brought me right there, and I knew he would take me into the interior. And I left all my anxious fears behind. I knew that I was going to have to live exactly like the people there, and that's not difficult. I had brought all kinds of things there. I expected to take over the trail into the interior with me because we arrived on the field in our first wedding anniversary. But I shoved them in under the counter of the Chinese store and left them there. You didn't take anything that wasn't absolutely necessary to the sustaining of life. Your carrier started at the base camp with a load that was 60 pounds in weight. We weighed every tin carefully because they had to go in on the backs of people, and people matter, things don't. And so we started over the trail. Your carrier ate 2/3 of that load while he was on the trail, so you arrived in the interior with a mere 20 pounds in each of your carrying tins. I went over one mountain range and then two and three and four and five, and then one day on the morning and the afternoon of the eighth day on the trail, I came to the top of the mountain and I looked down. I saw the first of the villages among these Stone Age primitive people to whom God had called us. This was the first time that a woman from the outside world had ever gone into the interior of the island. As I stood on the top of the mountain and I looked down at these people, I saw that the carriers had run on ahead to tell them that there were women in the outside world, and that was very important to them. Because, you see, for over a year and a half, I had sat on the coast teaching in the Bible school, waiting for the day when I could join my husband. One of the things that bothers me when I come back to America and I find young ladies and we talk about the mission field and I tell them that I have been as long as 5 months alone on my jungle station, they always say to me, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going with my husband wherever he has to go. Would you? Wouldn't you be willing to stay behind if by your being difficult, it meant that that tribe over there in the next mountain range and down into the next valley might not hear of Jesus Christ? Would you refuse to stay alone? I don't think you would. So I stayed behind. It was a year and a half before I ever got permission to go, and the reason we knew that God was going to take us there was that these people, and as I recorded their folklore right across the mountains from one valley to another, we found that these people thought that anything that is beyond the rim of mountains that surrounds your valley is a place of spirit beings. And here were all these men. And as the old chieftain said to Russell, he said, you are spirits. And if Christ died for you, then he didn't die for us. We're just human beings. Russell said, I'm not a spirit. He said, you must be. He pulled out this calendar. He said, look at it. And there tied were 18 knots every moon that had gone by since Russell first came, the first missionary that ever came into the interior. He said, you've been here 18 moons. You're a man. These who came with you later, they're all men, aren't they? He said, yes. He said, those with the expedition were men. Right. Those with the governor men. Those with the police, they're all men, aren't they? He said, yes. He said, all right. He said, if you have no children, you have no wives, if you aren't spirits, how did you come to existence in the first place? Well, how do you? And so when I got the letter, I knew in my heart that God was going to take me. I knew he was going to take me over that trail because there were no planes available. All of the planes had left that part of the Spice Islands. There were none to charter. And I knew God would take me into the interior. And just as Dr. Jaffrey said to me that day, he said, "Lassie," he said, "God has a people there for his name. He'll take you safely in." And here I was, and these people wanted to be sure there were human beings in the outside world. They were so excited they'd been up long before it was even light. They'd been down there running across the mountain and down into the villages, and they said, "There's a woman coming. She's coming just over the top of the mountain." And everybody was just pouring out of gardens, out of houses, running up the mountainside. And I looked down at them, and they started to yodel and shake their bow and arrow, and it makes a clicking sound as they yodel. Half the crowd goes, "Whoo!" And I was saying to the top of my lungs, "I'm home, I'm home, I'm home." And for 27 years, it's been my home. And that day, I was sitting down on the ground with all these sweet potatoes in my lap because I've never had so many sweet potatoes given me in one day in all my life. And I finally had so many I couldn't hold in my arms even, so I sat on the mountainside and they put them on my lap and then around me. And this old chieftain walked up from the village of Adupa there, and he looked down at me. He said, "Are you a woman?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "You are not." Turned down the door. I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Bill." One of the carriers had been on the trip with us. He came over and he tapped me on the shoulder. He said, "Mama, let your hair down." So I took my jungle hat off, and we realized after we'd been about 3 days out that these carriers had decided, "Oh, these are just men from the outside world trying to make us to think that they're women, that they really are human beings here." And so I had really quite long hair in those days. I laugh. During the days of the bombings, we ended up with one comb for 9 people, and livestock was plentiful, and so we cut off our hair real short, and then the war had to end. But I had real long hair, and then I did it in a roll around my head, and of course all they could see was this real short hair, just like the rest of the men had. And this morning, this fellow was pounding on the door of that little lean-to, yelling, "Hang on, anyway, quicker now, let's go!" And I had just pulled the pins out of my hair and it rolled out of my shoulder, and that fellow stepped out because when he hit the door, it fell in. I said, "Oh, my," he said, "Oh, mother mine, indeed you are a woman. No man ever had a hair like that." And he walked back in, he took all my hair and he pulled it out to see if it was attached on the other end. It was. I thought, that's a strange thing to do. But I found theirs everywhere. Put a man in a Stone Age culture, bring him over here to Western culture. They're all the same. They're really very vain. Especially when it comes to their hair. When your forehead, and the word for getting bald in the native languages, the forehead is traveling. When it's traveled back to here, as past complete tense, is a serious matter. You've got to cover it up. And we think we're so modern with our wigs here. Our people out there have had wigs for centuries. When your forehead is traveled back here, you get a cocoon from the caterpillars that we eat. The great big cocoons. You can get just hundreds of these black caterpillars in them. We know just when they're coming down trees and when they'll be ready to eat. But you can get one of these cocoons, put it over your head, put mud on that, and then put a net over it, and then put in the plumes of the cassowary bird, and you've got a tremendous head of hair. And this fellow was just checking to see if I was one of those whose forehead had traveled. And so he went out of there. He called all the others. Everybody else had to come in, all the carriers, and they pulled my hair, and they said, and then they said, "It's a woman, it's a woman." From that moment on, we couldn't move fast enough on that trail. And here was this old chieftain looking at me saying, "Boo." I know what was going through his mind because he was looking at my heavy boots with the cat's claws on them. He looked up at Russell coming down the trail, same kind of heavy boots. Heavy leggings because you wear them for the leeches. You take your baths at night in the river with your clothes on, wash off the mud, strip off your leggings, go over your legs with a match or iodine to get the leeches off. Same kind of heavy leggings. He looked back at my heavy khaki slacks, same kind of heavy khaki slacks. Looked back at my heavy khaki shirt, and because the alang-alang of the jungle, you always have it up just as high as you can, buttoned up tight and long sleeves. He looked back, the same kind of a heavy khaki shirt. He said, "You're not a woman." I said, "Yes, I am." And immediately I took my jungle hat off. I pulled the pins out of my hair, and when it rolled down over my shoulder, he dropped his bone arrow. He said, He said, "Oh, mother of mine." That's a man's expression. He said, "Indeed, you are a woman. I never saw a man with hair like that." Then he squatted down. He felt around among the sweet potatoes. And he found one that was still warm from the coals of the fire. He took it in his hands. And his hands had never been washed, not on purpose anyway. Rolled it in his hands when he blew on it. And then with his nice little paring knife that he wore on the end of the thumb, because our people are Stone Age, they belong to the Upper Paleolithic era. He had let his thumbnail grow to be about that long, nicest little paring knife you ever saw, and he peeled that sweet potato. Then he handed it to him, and he said, "Yagamo, no tonight, woman eat potatoes. The first of thousands I've eaten with my people." And that day, as I took it, I felt I'd been accepted. And I looked up into his face, and I said, "Someday, by the grace of Almighty God, I'll sit down and eat with you anew in my Father's kingdom." I saw the day when he passed from death to life in Jesus Christ. They are your people, young people. There's no problem of identification with your people out there, because your identification is not in the things that they do. It's in what you are. I found that those people, I went to them not because they're different, not because they're Stone Age, not because their skin is different, not because they rub pig fat and charcoal on them, not because they cut off their fingers or their ears. I went to them because they were exactly like me. They're lost apart from Jesus Christ, and there's no means of redemption except through the cleansing of the blood of Jesus Christ. Oh, what a thrill it was to be there and to be a part of these people. I have never known what it was to be homesick. And now we were opening a new area. And after the war, Jerry had been appointed already to New Guinea before I ever knew him, knew anything about him, before he ever knew me or knew anything about me. I remember the day when he was able to take the plane, go into the interior. He had made the trip, the initial trip that had to be made. He started out from the interior at the Whistle Lakes. The government said to us, "We're not going to let you go into that valley unless you can show us that in case something happens to that plane, that you can walk out of that valley back 250 miles across the mountains to the Whistle Lakes." The Whistle Lakes area was mapped. The Bali area was mapped. But in between was nothing but a white spot on the map. We didn't even know how high some of those peaks were there. Some of them were marked 14,000 feet, and you'd come to them, and you were climbing at 14,000 feet, and you still hadn't topped them. So Jerry got 55 carriers, and he started out. With a compass and altimeter, he filled in the maps as he went over the high country, found one valley, 25,000 people. The rest of the world didn't even know existed. Another valley of 40,000 people. And on he went. Over mountains like that, we don't carry two-way radio equipment. From the time he left me, I never knew where Jerry was until the day he would arrive home. The first trip he made, when he found the valley of 25,000 people, Jerry was gone 39 days. From the time he left that house until the night he came back, a rainy Saturday night, and I heard a knock at the back door, and I walked out, and there was all 220 pounds of him saying, "Lady, can you spare a dime for a cup of coffee?" And Jerry was home. He was starting out again. At least he knew. Up to the Ilaga Valley, where he was going, and from there on out, it was taking the altimeter and the compass and making a way toward the Balim Valley. His third day out after he left our camp, our base, I had a letter from him. I knew he had arrived in the next tribal area, the Moni country. One of the carriers had hurt his leg in the broken bottle limestone there and had to return. And then for another 2 months, I never heard another word from Jerry. But young people, I can tell you this morning from experience that God means here exactly what he says. He doesn't tell you. Be anxious for nothing if he doesn't provide the grace in order not to be anxious. I never knew an anxious moment for Jerry. Well, our people, they know how to tell the stories. There wasn't a moment after Jerry had left there but what I couldn't find someone who could tell me how the party had been attacked. And from the time they leave the territory in which you are, those people always have stories about the next tribe. Oh, they're vicious people, and they've killed them. They've ambushed them. And I would always say to them, "But how did you get this news?" "Well, I don't know, but so-and-so told me, and I don't know where he got it." But anyway, our people have just as marvelous imaginations as people here at home. Give them just a little clue, and they can build a tremendous story on it. And then a month went by, and the stories, the more they came, the worse they got. And I would always smile, and I'd say, "Well, have you seen any of the carriers?" They said, "No." Well, I said, "As long as we don't see any of our carriers coming back, let's not be anxious." And so 6 weeks went by, and still there was no word, and I didn't feel anxious because I knew that they were going to go until he got to the Balim Valley, and then he would turn around and come back again. And then 2 months went by, and one Saturday morning I walked out, and it had then been 65 days since I had heard anything from Jerry. And I saw this fellow standing there, and he said, "Mama, have you heard the latest?" And I said, "No, what is the latest?" He said, "Oh," he said, "it's terrible." He started to cry. He said, "You surely have heard it." He said, "Don't you know," he said, "that they were attacked by those Donnie people, those vicious people that carry spears?" And he said, "It's so bad that the whole city was wiped out." And he said, "Rose was sitting on his carrying tin when the attack came." And our people have an expression, and when you're graveyard dead, you're like this. And he said, here he was sitting on that carrying tin, and he said, "The spear went through him here," and he's... And I said, "Jacob, from whom did you hear that?" "Well," he said, "so-and-so told me." I said, "Who told him?" He said, "Someone else told him," and we tried to trace it down, and he couldn't tell who told this last one. And I said, "Have any of the carriers come back?" He said, "Oh, no." He said, "They were all wiped out. How could they come back?" I said, "But that news must have come back in some way." "Well," he said, "I don't know, but," he said, "it must be true." He said, "Two moons have gone by, and they're not back yet." And I smiled, and I went on about my work that day. And Sunday morning came. I walked into the church, this little church that's been built by our people. It's completely indigenous. These people are self-governing, self-propagating, and self-supporting, and they're sending missionaries on a shell and sweet potato economy to every valley we've opened up throughout the interior. And those people, with that kind of an economy, even bought aluminum for their roof, and they paid air freight into the interior on it. And I couldn't help but look at them and realize that if we were serious about this business of getting the gospel to the ends of the earth, we could have done it in our generation. I remember, I went to church that morning. I sat about the fourth row from the front. The national pastor stood up. He was one that I had once taught in Bible school and then before the war. And now he had taught Jerry the native language. And they had become very close, the one to the other, in the things of the Lord. And he stood up and he looked out over the audience. And then he broke down and started to cry. He said, "I'm sorry, but," he said, "we've all heard the stories." And he said, "it's been this long since Mr. Rose and the others left." He said, "the stories must be true. The party must have been wiped out." And he just broke down and sobbed. And I tell you, fear gripped me just like that. And I said, "Lord, am I so completely out of touch with you that I didn't realize the gravity of the situation?" And then he said, "If there is anyone at all here this morning who feels you could pray the prayer of faith, if anybody is left alive of that expedition, that you'll bring them back again." And then down on the front row, I saw a little old woman stand up. I remember the day, long time ago, before the war, when I was down on my knees on the floor of a little mud hut and led her to Jesus Christ. And then I realized she was just as much involved as I was, because her son was with Jerry. And I'll never forget it if I live to be 100. She just looked up. She didn't even close her eyes. She said, "Lord, by the way in which you took them out, just bring them home again. Thank you, Lord." And sat down. It was just like great waves of peace went over me. I thought, "I'm going to hear something soon from Jerry. They must be coming back soon." And I went home, and then the next morning got up. Our school started at 7:15. I went out early, and I saw coming across the flat someone, and the way he ran and the way his hair always stuck up just like two horns, I knew it was Joseph Yamo. And he had been on the station over there across the lake when I was alone for 5 months, when Jerry had been taken out to the coast in August. They said he was dying. I never heard another word from him for about a week. Finally, word came through to me that they were sending him back to America, dying of cancer. And for 3 months, I never heard another word from Jerry. But I can tell you this morning that I never knew an anxious moment for him either. God means to do exactly for us what he says he will. He either means it or he doesn't mean anything. I knew someday God would bring Jerry back again. 3 months later, I got word that he would be coming back around Christmas time. I knew this boy because in those months over there, he'd been one of those that used to go to the villages with me. I ran down the mountainside. I said, Joseph, you sure have a letter for me? He yelled. He said, I've got a letter for you. We reached the Barleem, and Rose will come into Kumopa, which is the first village coming back out of Moni territory into the Kapalka territory. I got the letter, and Jerry told how the Lord had enabled them to fill in the maps, to make it across the high country. There were nights when they would come into camp, and in sleet and driving rain, they had to set up their camp, and the camps would be sheathed in ice the next morning when they awakened. Difficult trip it was. He lost 30 pounds on that trip. And they said, but one day, he said, I came over the rise of a mountain, and I looked down, and I saw the Barleem stretched out before me. So he says, I'll be home, and it won't be long till we'll be back with these people again. And I knew that if he was coming into Kumopa that night, that he would come on downstream. It's the hardest of the 3 days, any 3 days you could ever spend anywhere on those trails in the interior. Everybody said to me, oh, well, he'll sleep there. You know how difficult it is coming from home, y'all. But I knew, Jerry, I knew that if he was anywhere near home, he's like a horse heading for the barn. I knew he'd be in. Some of the boys said to me, Mama, if you want that motor taken upstream, we'll take it up for you. And so they took it upstream for me, and I had everything in edible form that I could, because when they come off of these trips, they're hungry. There are many stretches in there where there are no sweet potato gardens, nothing, and it's difficult to carry enough supplies with you. And then I went out about 10 o'clock that night, and we had six of these children living in the home with us, and they'd gotten tired, and they'd swept the floor, and by sweeping the floor, you just pour water down through the bamboo mat and let all the dirt and everything be carried on down below. They'd gotten everything cleaned up, and finally they became tired, and I saw them nod, and one slipped under the staircase, and one went in under the table, and one behind the stove, and they all had their places where they slept. And then I waited another 2 hours, and I thought, well, if he isn't coming by now, I'll go to bed. And it was midnight, and it was 67 days from the time he had left me. And I went out, and I saw a little tiny light coming around the corner of the mountain that juts out into the lake. And I knew, after 67 days, Jerry was home again. Now he was back in the Barleem, and this time by plane. I wanted to go in with him. The governor said to me, I couldn't possibly give you permission to go in there. He said, those people are cannibals. He said, they're dangerous. He said, you're going to have to just stay out here until a government post is established in the interior. Oh, I thought, a government post? My, we've been places in there when for years a government post has never been established. We were in the Bowling Valley for over 2 years before they even brought the government post in. And yet I realized what a difference it made in the attitude of the people, not only toward you, but toward your message. When there were no women in the party, and they had become anxious and fearful of the men, and they never saw women unless perhaps they had a bad case of yaws and wanted to come down to get a shot of penicillin. And so one day I thought, Lord, for the sake of our people and for the sake of the gospel, make it possible for me to get into that valley. And that afternoon, a car came out from one of the men who was the advisor to the Queen for all interior affairs. But this man had been our patrol officer at the Whistle Lakes before the war. He was heading up an expedition going into the Barleem Valley. And Victor Bryan sent out word. He said, if you can, make arrangements for the little boy. I want you to be a member of the government expedition going in this week into the Barleem Valley. He said, I remember what a change came when you finally came into the interior there before the war at the Whistle Lakes. So he said, if it's possible, I want you to be on the first plane load going into the interior. I had this little boy, Bruce was then about a year old, and I thought, Lord, if this is the plan for me to go in now, you surely know where I'm going to leave my little boy. I left it to the Lord. It's very easy for us to go to other people and impose our children on them. They have their responsibilities, and I have felt that if God lays it on their hearts, they'll offer, if this is in his program. And late that afternoon, here came the wife of one of the mechanics. She said, I just heard about it. She said, you surely can't take the little baby with you. Could you let us keep it while you're gone? And I said, thank you, Lord. There was my answer. This was the time for me to go. And so I got Bruce ready and took him down to their home the next day, and I left on the plane These people had never seen a person from the outside world before, a woman. I remember that day when the plane finally landed and they opened up the door of the plane. I could hear them calling, and they hadn't dared to come up close enough to the plane landing site because it's on one of these no man's lands. And when the first camp was established there, the people had ambushed those from the other side of the river and killed seven of them right there on the doorstep of the camp. That's why we finally moved away from there, lest we be identified with these massacres that took place. And so I could see them, and I could say, oh my, those birds of paradise are really close down here. But it was the headdresses of these men they had on all their battle attire. These beautiful headdresses made from the fur of the opossum or the native dog, the wild dog there. It looks like an Egyptian basenji. And then in this, they put the plumes of the cassowary birds and the parakeets and the white herons, and they're very beautiful. And I could see all these, and then I could hear them yelling, hey, hey, woman you, mama, mama, hey, mama, woman you. And I was waving at the birds of paradise plumes, and I couldn't see their faces because they blended into the jungle back there. But when we got down the river and I stepped out of the boat, they just enveloped me, hundreds of these people. And then the women started to pour in on the property. I remember that afternoon we had been invited by the chieftain, Ukumherik. He's the most powerful chieftain that we know of anywhere in the interior. And I was concerned that my contact with these people would be pleasing to the Lord for the sake of our witness to them. And you can destroy so very much when you first go in. There are things you don't understand. That's why it's absolutely necessary that your life and your speech is completely under the control of the Holy Spirit. You could destroy the very thing you came to bring them the news of. I remember that afternoon when we went up to the village, Ukumherik. I had been studying the language by means of tapes. Everything that they could send out to me, I was absorbing on the coast. I knew how to answer greetings. They have a great long line of greetings, and you answer. You have a certain response to each one of these. But I also knew that women did not go down into the men's enclosure. The men and the initiated boys sleep in the roundhouses. The women and the pigs and the boys who haven't been initiated sleep in the longhouses. And so I looked down, I saw this longhouse down there, and the men were going over the stile into the men's enclosure, and so I started on down the trail to visit with the women. I heard someone yelling, hey, hey, and I walked on, and suddenly I realized I was the only woman around there, so I turned around, and I looked, and here was the chieftain going, hey, hey, and I turned around, and I said, woman, you, and he was motioning for me to come. You never beckon this way, nobody knows what you're doing. I learned a lot of things you just don't do. You point to something and they look at the end of your finger. Wonder what's wrong with that. You don't point with your finger. Of course you don't. You point with your chin. It's over there. It's very convenient when you have your hands full. Some of these things become such a part of you, it's very hard to unlearn them when you come back to the States. And so I turned around and I walked back there and he kept motioning for me to come on over the stile into the men's enclosure. And then he took my arm and I saw that there was a line of men standing up in front of that roundhouse. This was his roundhouse, the chieftain's Ukumherik. I was introduced to Waganago, the witch doctor, and then this man and this man. And finally came to the last of the men there. And our people in Kapalco country, when you're the visitor, you extend your index finger. And they take it between these two fingers. And the louder the click, the better your welcome is. I nearly lost that little thing my first week there. They're rough hands. But these people, the Donnies, didn't. The Donnies shake hands just like we do. When I got to the last man, I put out my hand, but he didn't take my hand. He just reached around, put his arms around my shoulder like this, and he said, and he gave me a greeting, and I put my arms around his shoulder, and I answered the greeting, and then he gave me another greeting, and I answered the greeting, and answered it, and then it went on, and I really thought he wasn't going to run out of greetings, and I was getting kind of nervous. Afterwards, the men said to me, we weren't sure whether you were being greeted or whether they were tenderizing you. I finally finished the last of the greetings, and I sort of moved away from him, and I said to Jerry, I said, I'm not sure I like that kind of a greeting. He said, oh, honey, he's a blind as a bat. He probably thought he was hugging another man. But the man was Ukumherik's father, a very powerful man in the tribe. And then Ukumherik took me over and told me where to sit. And there was a bundle of dry grass for each one of us to sit on. I sat down right in the center, and then the others were in this semicircle, fanned out around the edge of the village enclosure. And then they brought out a pig, And they shot it behind the right front leg so that all the bleeding is done internally. You have the blood then to mix with your sweet potato leaves and other things in the cooking pit afterward. And then they turned it over and over on the coals of the fire, burning off the hair and the pig fleas and the ticks. And then they scraped it with a bamboo knife, and in the process, the insides began to bubble and boil. And when they started with their bamboo knife and cut out this piece of fat down the stomach and pulled it out, just everything gurgled out and the pig was butchered. And then you take out, there's not a thing about a pig that you can't eat. You take the intestines down to the river and wash them out, turn them inside out, bring them up, drip dry them to go back into the pit later on. All the bones are taken out, and you have the tenderloin and the spare ribs, except those in the legs, the tenderloin and the spare ribs, roasted on the coal of the fire so you can have something to eat while you're waiting for the rest of this big pig to cook in the pit with the hot stones. The older men had been heating the stones until they were white hot. They lined this pit with grass. Then they put in the hot rocks. They put in the sweet potatoes, then the sweet potato leaves that had been soaked in the blood. They just grab up a handful and mop up a little blood so they don't lose any of it. All of this went in. Over the top of it, they stretched this big piece of pork, and then they put in the more hot rocks, pulled all this grass up around it, dripped water on it, and in an hour and 40 minutes, that big pig was beautifully cooked. It really is delicious when it comes in these pits, cooked in these pits. And I thoroughly enjoy it. Then when we sat down, he came over and he sat down right in front of me. He had these ribs in his hand with his bamboo knife. He was cutting off one, and he would hand it to this fellow over here, and he'd cut off another and hand it to this one, cut off one and hand it to me, and cut off another and hand it to this one, on down the line. And I was watching him. He sat there, and he was watching me eat them, and I was thoroughly enjoying this. And I thought I did a real good job cleaning that rib off. And I put it down on the grass in front of me, and I was watching him clean his toes because there's a lot of pig dung and mud on the trails there. And so I sat there eating and watching him. And finally, I realized that every time I put one of these bones down, he'd pick it up. And with that nice long paring knife I was telling the girls about that they wear on the end of their thumbs, he was working all of this membrane and these little bits of flesh that I had left on that bone off. Then he'd work it out from under his nail and put it on his thigh, and he left it there, and he'd pick up one over here from one of the other fellows, and he'd clean that all off and work it out from under his thumbnail, put it on his thigh, and when he had enough for a bite size, he picked it up and plopped it in my mouth, and I ate it. I remember the one old fellow, he was the soil expert. He was an old man. He really was. He jumped up just like that, and he ran around on the other side, and as he went by, he said, "Tell that man that I'm a very, very old man. I have a very, very sick stomach, and I never eat pork." And there he stood over on the side of the enclosure, and he was watching us. He said to me afterwards, he said, "Mrs. Rose, how could you do that?" I said, "Do what?" He said, "Eat that dirty stuff out from under his nail, off of his dirty leg." And I said, "You know, Mr. Fendalman, I didn't know what you were thinking, but I knew what your stomach was doing. He was just pea green." And then they brought out, they opened up the pit. And the choice piece of all, if you don't know how to eat fat, you don't know how to eat pork at all. The choice piece of all to them is that strip of fat down the stomach with the teats on it. And they laid it out in front of me as a guest of honor. That was my piece. And I didn't mind it was just the size of it that bothered me. I wondered how I was ever going to get through that piece of fat. And if I could get through it in a hurry, I knew I could get some of that ham that Jerry had. Because he told me, when he first came in, he didn't get the hind leg of a pig. He didn't really care much about pork, and he'd always slice off a hind leg and hand it to him. There he was working on that. I thought, if I get through this, then I can have some of that. And I kept an eye on him. And then I had finished this big piece of fat. And when you roast it or you steam it in the pits, it becomes very white and very mealy, and it really is very good. And then they brought out the next choice piece, which is the lower jaw with the tongue still resting between the teeth. And I got that piece, and that was a new experience. And then there were five bundles of these intestines that had been wrapped up with succulent leaves, and I got one of them as a guest of honor. And when I had finished eating and I looked up at this man, they had been conferring together, and so all of the men and the witch doctor, everybody came up, and they pressed my nose with their finger. They said, "Heaven meet McKay, you're one of our kind." And the next one come along, he said, "Not Mogwai, you're one of our kind." And everybody had pressed my nose, and then the chieftain said to me, he said, "We have talked it over, and we are going to take you into the leading clan of the Osceola Waddles as my daughter." He said, "From now on," he said, "every privilege of a daughter is yours." I didn't know until later what tremendous privileges that meant. I found that I couldn't even say to my people that I'm hungry for something like spinach. I did one day. I said, oh, we haven't had spinach for so long. Been 5 or 6 days. I said, I'm so hungry for spinach. That fellow walked out of the house. He was gone about 2 hours, came back in, walked in, laid his net out. Here he had gone home and had killed a little suckling pig and had steam-cooked spinach with it and brought it back. And I was just floored. I said, Sugunidhi, why did you do that? Why did you kill that little pig instead of waiting for it to grow up? He said, you said you were hungry for spinach and you're the daughter of the chieftain, so I had to get you spinach. And I learned my lesson that day. I never again said, I want something. I say, I have to buy something. And then they would go and get it, and I would purchase things when they were available. If I were hungry, I could go into any garden in that clan, and I could dig my sweet potatoes, and nobody would ever have questioned it. And the fellow looked down at me, and he said, you'll always be called my daughter. There among the people, the women, half of them address me as Naksu, which is my sister. The other half call me Nagoleak. One means my sister. The other is my sister-in-law. And I said, why do you call me Nagoleak, my sister-in-law? Why, they said, we belong to the other moiety, the other half of the clan. Aren't you the chieftain's daughter? Well, then you're our sister-in-law. This fellow looked down at me and he said, Mama, not Lavogi, my daughter, this. I looked up at him. I knew the response when a man says, my daughter to you is my father, no paseyi. And so I said, no paseyi, this, my father. He looked a little startled, and then he leaned over and he said something to one of the other men. And I couldn't help but smile because I realized what was going through his mind was, he looked down at me and I said, no paseyi. He thought, oh, I'm not really too much older than she is. And so he said, now will you tell her that from now on I will always address her as my Natlogo, my daughter, but ask her, would she mind calling me Nero, which means fellow clansmen of the same age level, the opposite sex. And from that time on, whenever he comes anywhere near the property, I hear him calling Natlogo, Yehemakumawedek, my daughter, where are you? And I run out and answer, fellow clansmen of the same age level, the opposite sex, here I am. I realized God had given us a wonderful entrance into the hearts of those people. And I learned in those days that even before you know the language, what you are is all important. Before you even know to tell them that God had a son and his name was Jesus, and he died on Calvary in their behalf, they watch everything you do. And then they consider, God is like this person. Jesus is like this one. That's the way it ought to be, shouldn't it? This old world, many of them have no Bibles to read. And you never live to yourself, and you never die to yourself. And what you do is absolutely important from the time you awaken in the morning till you go to sleep at night. You don't know who's watching you. And sometimes God allows you to go through experiences in order to show himself to your people. Anxious? Yes, beloved, I could have been anxious many a time there. There were times when we didn't know whether we'd be alive the next moment or not. There was a time within that next month after I had gone out and gotten little Bruce and brought him back in again. They didn't believe I had a little boy out on the coast. Their children are nursed until they're 2 and 3 and 4 years of age. They said, how big is that child you say you've got out there? I said, well, he's about the size of, and I'll point to one of theirs. They said, who's feeding that child? I said, oh, we have milk that comes in tins. They rolled on the ground laughing. Who ever heard of a tin giving milk? And I'm sure they didn't believe it. And I went out, and the governor had told me before. He said, you can't go in. You can't take that little boy in there. But I knew that God was preparing the way. And when I got out, I had word from the government official that I was to appear at a reception at the government house that night. I knew what he was going to tell me. I packed already. I had everything ready. When I came down through the reception line, and I had known this man before because he was in the same cell with my husband during those war years, my first husband who died. He looked me up as soon as I came to New Guinea. He said, I wanted to talk to you because, he said, I had never known a man who knew God like that man did. He said, I can remember times there when I would hear that man praying. And he said, I have looked to see if Jesus was standing there because he was talking to someone he knew. Are your prayers cliches? Or do you know the one you're talking to? God is alive and Jesus is living within us. He's the most vital, wonderful, thrilling being there ever was. And he walks with you from the time you awaken in the morning till you go to sleep at night and in the night hours. How often he'll awaken you just to talk to you. He said, Darlene, I just called you out tonight because I won't have time to come out to the Centauri Strip. He said, I wanted to tell you that you have my permission and you can take the little boy in. He said, how soon can you be ready? I said, I'm all packed. I'm leaving tomorrow morning. I went down to see the pilot after I got home. He said, yes, I can switch the loads tomorrow. I'll take you in. And the next day with the little boy, I was on my way back into the interior. I remember the times when through the awful satanic forces and powers that were manifest there. Don't ever forget you're coming onto the devil's territory. In these places, no one had ever challenged him before. And it was just like Dr. Jaffrey said to me when I first went to New Guinea. He said, you will never have seen such forces of darkness as you'll see them now because nobody has ever challenged him. But he said, I want you to remember this, Lassie, that in nothing by him be affrighted, for greater is he that's in you than he that's in the world. He was defeated on Calvary, and you don't need to be afraid. We were under attack this time for 3 days and 3 nights. These people had become fearful. 3 little kiddies had been working on the strip because the plane had crashed. It was over a month that we looked for that plane from the air, and it was one solid month before we finally found the wreckage on the mountainside. It was 5 years because of hostile tribes before we got to the wreckage of the plane. And we had to have a strip. The only thing that could service us then was a Piper Pacer with fixed floats on it. And at that altitude, the performance was nil. The payload was 100 pounds. I said to Jerry, let's hope nothing happens to you. You have to go out in 3 pieces. We had to have a strip. Jerry was ill. Jerry had been injured on the coast by doctors with maluse of instruments. I knew enough about medicine, and I had my Merck's manual there. I knew that uremic poisoning was backing up into his system. I could see his eyesight going. I knew that he was bloated because of the uremic poisoning. He was a ghastly gray color. And yet that fellow, for 3 months, Jerry never knew what it was to be free of a headache. And yet he worked from early in the morning till it was too dark to see at night, in order to get that strip completed. I'd gone up this day with him because I wanted to get some mail on the little plane that was coming in. I wanted to do some washing. I had a scrub board, and the other missionary that had come had a machine operated by a little gasoline engine. I wanted to do my sheets in it. I looked up. We saw about 200 of these warriors completely covered with black charcoal, pig fat. They had their spears, they had their bows were strung, and they don't string their bows until they're ready for the battle. I said to the others, we're going to eat, I'm going to fix a meal for you. The other missionary lady was very ill at the time. She had malaria and hepatitis. She hadn't slept all night long. And I walked into the house. I said, we're going to eat. She said, I can't eat. She said, they've been here at the windows all night jabbing at them. Every trail we crossed from our station up to there was covered with the taboos and the tied grass. We'd stop and we'd plead the covering of the blood and refuse the powers of darkness, and we walked right around them and went on. And there they were, just completely surrounding the place. I went out, I lighted the fire and got my water going, and then I went back in the house and I got the sheets, and I went out to put the first load in the machine, and Jerry came out to be with me. I looked up. They weren't any farther than this third row from me. There they stood, about 200 of them. And I put my sheets down into the machine, and I was praying that God would alert people at home to pray for us, because I knew that this was a contest with the powers of darkness. Those people don't attack us because they don't like us. They have been under the direction of demons, And I found out, I don't have the time to tell you about it. We've seen them manifest in the forms of lights and many other manifestations. And I knew that we needed prayer, God's people at home. I'm so glad there's always been someone in contact with the throne. I put the first load down into the machine. Jerry standing there, I saw the chieftain, this man who had adopted me as his daughter, come up behind Jerry. He grabbed his arms and pulled him around behind him, and there he stood, and he said to the men, "Come, put the spear through him." I looked up at them. They didn't move. Finally, Ukumherik just dropped his hands and turned and walked away. We didn't know at the time what that order meant. We found out later that when they can catch one of the enemy group, they're still alive, they stand them in the middle of the battlefield. They start the spear right in here, inside of the collarbone, and run it down through the body until they can pin them to the battlefield. That was the command that Ukumherik had given. Not one of those men moved. That's the only time I ever knew that man to give an order, and it wasn't obeyed without a question asked. Those men couldn't move. I learned later, and as he said, there was a power there. I can't explain it, but he said, I couldn't move. And the men said, we saw things in the hills we couldn't explain. I'll tell you what they were. They were the angels of God. But back here in America, and we got the letter 6 weeks later, there was a man going out of his house down in Fresno, California. This man said, I started down to the post office. And he said, I just left the house, gone down the steps, and walked a few steps when I felt a hand on my shoulder. And he said, I turned around, there wasn't anybody there, and the Lord spoke to me. He said, go back in the house and pray for the roses and the Van Stones. He said, I went back in the house, and he said, for hours I wrestled in prayer. I have never known what it is to weep before God like I did that day. He said, sometime, if you have time, would you just write and tell me what it was? By the exact time change, that afternoon in Fresno, California, was the time there in the Baling Valley when that man held Jerry's arms behind him and gave the command to put the spear through him. Beloved, I can tell you from experience today that when God says, be anxious for nothing, he means even for your life. I remember the day when, after we had established this one station and we had gone up, and we had got established the station in this new area that I told you about. And this is just February 9 and 10 of 2 years ago. Very often I'm alone on the station, sometimes a month, sometimes 3 months. I've been 5 months alone. I was there on the station, and I knew that the situation in the valley was very bad. The government was so frightened of the people that they had flown in 3 Dakota loads of police to bolster up their stations. They were that frightened. They said, it's possible there's going to be a wholesale massacre of everybody here unless we get more police. And so they flew in 3 Dakota loads of police. I knew also that within a matter of even days, I could be thrown back into an internment camp. This was the time when the Indonesians were dropping thousands of paratroopers into New Guinea. And war was imminent. And I'll be very frank with you. There were times there when I would awaken at night and I faced war again. And I would say, Lord, you don't really mean for me to go through another one, do you? So sweetly his presence would fill that room and I'd go off to sleep. There have been times not long before this when with my little boys there on the station, I would hear warriors outside in the night hours, and my little boys would become frightened in the night and had nightmares. And I have taken those little boys and I pulled them into bed with me, and I face the question every missionary mother faces: do I have a right to bring my children into this? I've gone off to sleep time and time again, hearing the click of their spears on the aluminum roof of the house, but never knew when they left the property. In the morning, we'd awaken to find their footprints under the windows, little bundles of things they had brought that they had stolen from us or gotten from us. And they'd leave it behind because the witch doctor said they had to, or their pigs would get sick and die. I remember this morning, it was the 9th day of February. I had gone down, and at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's very unusual not to find people already outside your door. People with potatoes to sell, or spinach, or just want to talk to you, or want to come in and sit and watch you. We never locked the door of our house. But there wasn't anybody there. And so I hurried, and we had breakfast, little Brian and I, because Jerry was away on the trip. And then, at 8 o'clock, there still was no one there. And the radio scared came on, and I answered the coast that everything was fine. I'd seen out in the station, went off the air. Still, there was no one there. And when you're under attack, I learned that your people just have nothing to do with you, and you begin to consider, well, now, what is it this time? I had gone upstairs. We had a two-story house there. We had one room downstairs and one room upstairs. And I went upstairs. You can get so much more floor space under a little bit of roof then. And so I'd gone upstairs. I said to Brian, you play here, and Mommy's going up, and I'll be down shortly. I wanted to pray. I laid my Bible out in front of me. I got down on my knees next to the bed. And before I could even read a verse, the Lord said to me, not a hair of your head shall perish. I tell you, I was shaken from head to foot. I was in terror. What did he mean? I knew that right down there in an area south to us on a station that someone had panicked. I knew that they had sent word up to get police, and the police had come down, and the police had shot three of this headman's, Ukumherik's, largest pigs, and they're the animal sacrifice. They would have been much better off to have killed three of his wives. He had 22 of them. He would not have taken it as hard as to have three of those animals of sacrifice, and they're the big pigs that are used during the rites when they consult with the demons for what they will do within the next period of moons until they have the next feast. And then the fellow himself went down and shot two of that man's pigs. It was absolutely wrong. That man, Ukumherik, my father, had nothing to do with the situation there. These people were coming down to him to ask what their attitude should be concerning what was going on at that time. And he panicked, this fellow. He had sent for the police. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what was going on. I just knew that nobody was there. And suddenly I realized something's going to happen in this valley, or I'm going to be thrown into another prison camp. And I was so panic-stricken, I took up my Bible. I couldn't even find a verse that was marked. And then I went over to my desk, and my promise box was open. And I reached in. I said, Lord, you've got to do something for me. And with my hand just trembling, I finally got hold of a verse, and I pulled it out. And when I unrolled it, what do you think it was? Luke 21:18, there shall not a hair of your head perish. And the fear was gone. It just completely drained out of me. I knew that whatever took place in that day or the days to follow, that God had promised that I'd come out of it safely. I took an air form, and I wrote a letter to my mother. I remembered those days when for more than 4 years my father and mother heard absolutely nothing from us. I never heard anything from them. I didn't even know where they were till I finally got back to America. And I said, Mother, I don't know whether it's in connection with the situation here in the valley, but it's so grave that they have flown in three Dakota loads of police, and there's been an incident in the area to the south of me. Or I said, it could be, Mother, in connection with the Indonesian situation, because they're dropping thousands of paratroopers here into New Guinea right now. But I said, even if for months, Mother, you hear nothing from me, someday you will, and you'll find that we're all right, because this morning while I talked to him, he talked to me. He said, not a hair of our head shall perish. I sealed the letter. I heard the door opening downstairs. I went down, and here was a young man from a nearby village. He had been sent by the first of the believers that we led to the Lord Jesus Christ in this area. And he motioned for me to squat down next to him, and I got down next to him, and they whisper things when it's very important. He said, Mama, Suguni Lee sent me through the lines before dawn to tell you to take the little one and flee to the government camp because they're coming to kill you and the little boy. He said, you see, they've killed five of Ukumherik's pigs. He said, all night long we've been in the jungle up here behind the house trying to decide how we'd avenge our chieftain. And he said they went down through every village, every station, the police stations, mission stations. He said every station in this valley either has police or several couples on it. And you're the only one. You don't even have a station hand here, and you're alone with the little boy. And so finally, early this morning, they decided They'd have to kill you and the little boy. They're going to chop up your bodies and throw them in the river that runs behind the house. No one will ever know what happens to you. And that's very possible. That river behind our house drops 6,000 feet in just 12 miles. So he said, Sugunili told me to run before dawn, get the word to you, to flee to the government camp with the little boy, so that you won't be here when they come. I said to the fellow, I'm so glad that Sugunili cared and he sent you, and I want you to go back now, and I want you to tell him that this morning, while I was up there talking to Jesus, he talked to me, and I don't dare leave here. You see, God promised to keep me safe. He said, not a hair of my head shall perish. I don't dare leave this station because this is where God promised to keep me safe. And go back and tell him. About an hour and a half or 2 hours later, I heard the door opening again. I went out. Here was Sugunili, the young man himself. He walked over and he dropped on his knees and motioned for me to kneel down beside him. And then with the tears running down his cheeks, he said, Mama, please don't stay. Please don't stay. He said, take that little boy and flee to the government camp. He said, they're coming. I've been with them all night. I know what's going to happen. He said, they've killed Ukumhearik's pigs. And he said, you're the only one that's alone. And Horosi is away. Rose is gone. And they're coming to get you and the little boy. And they're going to kill you. Then they're going to chop up your bodies. And nobody will ever know what happened to you. He said, don't stay here. I put my hand on his shoulder. I remembered the day on the floor, kneeling with him just like this. I'd led that man to Jesus Christ. I said, Sugunili, thank you for coming. But I want to tell you something, Sugunili. I don't dare leave here. You see, God promised to keep me safe right here on the station. I said this morning while I was talking to Jesus, he talked to me. He said, not a hair of your head shall perish. So I don't dare leave here. You see, this is where I'm safe. And you know, I learned a lesson then. The faith that God had given me sparked the faith in that young man's heart. And I want to read you a verse that later the Lord brought to my mind from Deuteronomy. Because what you are and your fearfulness and your anxiety is not only devastating to you, but it has an awful effect to people around you. And I'm reading the Berkeley version because it's Deuteronomy, the 20th chapter, and the 8th verse. And this is what it says in the Berkeley version. Finally, the officers shall say to their soldiers, is there a man here who is afraid and weak-hearted or anxious? Let him go home, lest he impart fear in other men, and they likewise become faint-hearted or anxious. How I thank God that he had removed anxiety from my heart, because I could see what a devastating thing it could have been to that young believer. And I put my hand on his shoulder and I said, Sugunili, I don't dare leave here. This is where I'm safe. And that faith the Lord had given me sparked the faith in his heart, and he looked up and his face just broke into a light. He said, you're right, Mama. Jesus will take care of us. And I never knew until later that during the night hours, when they were figuring out how they could avenge their chieftain, they had gone through every other station and finally ended up with me and the little boy alone on that station. This young man stood up and he said, how could you think to do that to Mama Horosi? He said, don't you realize that she loves us, what she and Horosi have come to mean to us? And then the men turned on him and they said, so you're one of Jesus' kind too. This young man, they said, and I learned this from the headmen of the tribe, they said, that young man stood up and he straightened his shoulders. He said, all right. He said, there was a time when I didn't know him. But he said, one day, down on the floor of their house, Mama Horosi led me to Jesus Christ. He said, go down. He said, kill my little daughter, Oma, and kill Kili, my wife, and you can kill me. But he said, I've come to know Jesus. And he said, I wouldn't deny him for anything. And those men said that testimony from that man did more than all the sermons they'd ever heard me give. And then I realized how if I had been faint-hearted, what a devastating thing it could have been in the life of that young believer. We had prayer together, and we committed ourselves to God who had promised to keep us safe, and he disappeared. The afternoon hours wore on, and I looked down the trail, and here came Jerry coming home. The Lord brought him home just the right time. He had taught me the lesson he wanted to teach me. I told Jerry what had happened. We knew the safest place for us was right there on our Sinatma station. We went to bed that night. About 3:30 in the morning, 2:30, I suddenly awakened by hearing this awful, blood-curdling battle cry. And I tell you, when you look up and see them coming down at you and shrieking this battle cry, it's a high falsetto, and it's a yodel, and they screech. And it'll turn your blood to jello at any time of the day, but in the middle of the night, oh, I just suddenly heard this. And then I jumped up, and then I remembered God had said not a hair of our head shall perish. Jerry and I walked to the window. It was a full moonlight night. We looked down. We could see them moving in from the property below. You could see they were armed. You could see their bows were strung. We could hear them coming. There must have been hundreds of them. They were coming from across the river as well. And I went over to the edge of the bed where the little boy was sleeping, and I pulled the covers up tight around him. And all I could ask, all that I needed to ask that night was that my little boy wouldn't hear the battle cry, so that he wouldn't become frightened. I remembered what it had meant to Bruce, our oldest boy. I have never known one of those little fellows to ever complain in all the times we'd been through these attack valley. But the day came when Bruce was 6 years of age and had to go away to school. I took him down and put him on the plane. The little fellow looked up at me and he said, "Mommy, must I go?" And I said, "Yes, Brucie, you must go." Then with tears, he looked up at me and he said, "But Mommy, if anything happens to you and Daddy and Bubby, I don't have anybody. I'll be all alone." I said, "Lord, you can keep this little boy sleeping, but he'll never know that this night the place was surrounded. He never knew until we came back to America and he heard me telling the story that 9th and 10th of February we were surrounded by hundreds of these people. That's my God. That's what he can do. Only a miracle could have kept that child from hearing that awful battle cry." I went back to the window with Jerry. We looked out, and as they began to move in, I suddenly saw the hand of Almighty God reach down. And in an instant of time, he had pulled a black curtain of clouds over that moon, and just like that, we were in such darkness, we couldn't even find our way to the bed. And those people began to scream in terror, and they were running in every direction. And they fled to their homes. The next day, nobody came. There was no one there. The next night, we went to bed. We went to sleep. Suddenly, in the middle of the night again, we were awakened by this awful, blood-curdling battle cry. We jumped up again. We went to the window, and we looked out, and we saw them moving in from below the property. We could hear them coming from across the river, and we knew they were moving in this time from the jungle above the house. We were surrounded on three sides. On the other side was enemy territory. Over again, I pulled the covers up against little Brian's neck, and I said, "Lord, you kept him sleeping last night. You keep him sleeping tonight again." And then we walked the room. Do you know what we were singing? "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name." God was so present in that room. It was like a great shining light. Walked back to the window. And again, the hand of Almighty God reached down and wrought a miracle for two of the least among his servants. He had just pulled a black curtain of cloud over that full moon, and in an instant, we were in awful darkness, and so were those people. We found our way to the bed. A storm hit. It rained and stormed all night long till 7 o'clock the next morning. Sunday morning, that was Wednesday and Thursday night, Sunday morning, the witch doctors, the headmen of the tribe, all of the men were there, sitting in that service, waiting to hear about Jesus. I spoke that morning on Paul and Silas in the Philippian jail. I hadn't even thought about what had taken place on Wednesday and Thursday nights. But you know, when I came to that part of the story where the Lord sent the earthquake to deliver his children from the hands of these wicked people, with such a rush of joy, I realized that the God of Paul and Silas was my God. And I said to the people, "And the God that Paul and Silas served is the God that I serve, and he still uses the elements to deliver his children." And to my utter amazement, I saw those witch doctors and those head men turning around to get one another's eyes, and they were going like this, and they were nodding. What had they learned on Wednesday and Thursday nights? I'll tell you what they learned. that there was a God in Israel that still answers by fire. Those men knew that it was the hand of Almighty God that had wrought that miracle and blackened the moon, and they told us so. And from that moment on, God began to move in among our people. And then suddenly I realized, what a privilege, young people. What a privilege it is that God will trust us to take us through circumstances like that. Why? Because we need it? Not necessarily. And then I saw Daniel. Here was Daniel, that young man. His life was under threat. What did he do? Did he get into a closet where nobody could see him and say, Lord, this is a serious situation. Now you've got to do something about it. I never seen it before. That man went to the window, threw the windows open, and he prayed just like he always did. How current is your experience with Almighty God? Do you have to make preparations to enter into his presence? It wasn't Daniel that needed that lion's den experience. It was a heathen king that needed to know there was a God in Israel. He was the one who didn't sleep. Daniel slept. The next morning, before it was even light, he was down there and he was calling in, oh, Daniel, is thy God able? And what did Daniel answer? My God is abundantly able. My God is able. Listen, young people, you're in a heathen world. Right here in America, too. And that heathen world is looking down on you in every circumstance that comes to your life, and they're asking you with hope within their hearts that you'll answer in the affirmative. They say, young people, is thy God able? What do you answer? My people knew that God was able. From that time on, I didn't have enough voice or enough time to preach. I worked in this dialect. They sent word, the head witch doctor of all witch doctors said, come up here. It's a new area, the Walite. They said, we've got all the wood for a house for you. I couldn't believe it. Never had happened before anywhere in New Guinea. You had to haggle over ground, haggle over the wood. We went up. Jerry went up first. The head witch doctor of all the witch doctors in our area said, Rose, where do you want to build the house? That never happened before either. He said, just look it over. Any place you want. Jerry found a place with two streams on either side of a good drainage. He said, and it was a cane stand, so we knew it wasn't a garden bed lying fallow. Jerry said, is this all right? He didn't even answer. Jerry gave an order like bulldozers. Men, women, and children went through that thing in a half hour, had it completely denuded. He gave another order. They went into the jungle. They came out, and they had wood. And here were these planks. And then he said, don't build it like ours. He said, build it like yours with holes in the wall so we can see your faces when you talk to us. Jerry said, I can't use this type. Their logs are thick in the middle and they're feathered out at either end. He said, all right, what do you need? He said, I need them as long as you can make them, as wide as you can make them, about an inch thick. With their stone axes and stone adzes, they had done this work. The fellow said, all right, go on home. When we're ready, we'll call you back again. We thought we've got plenty of time. We had four stations we were responsible for at the time. We've got plenty of time to go up there. But before more than 4 days had passed by, the word came down, said, come on up, the wood's all ready. Jerry couldn't believe it. Never happened before. He went up. Here were planks, some of them 18 inches wide and 12 to 13 feet long. Hard wood, harder than mahogany. 1 inch thick. And there it was. He built the house. He said, now, I don't know this dialect, but I'm going home, and Mama and the little one will come up, and they'll teach you. When I arrived there, I found at 7 o'clock in the morning, over 300 people were already sitting there waiting when I got up. I went out. I started to teach them. You start at Genesis. You've got to lay a good foundation. You can't go in there and just put another cloak over their old cloak of heathenism. And so I started with Genesis. And I went on through the story of God dealing with his people, how sin came into the world, why it was necessary for Christ to die. They must understand that. And then how Christ was the Lamb of God to take away the sin of the world. And God said, I don't want to see the blood of animals any longer. And when I had finished, about 3 hours later, I didn't have any voice left because the people had kept coming. And I keep talking louder. And so I said to them, I don't have any voice left, but you go off and dig your potatoes and come right back and I'll teach you some more. They went off on a run, they dug the potatoes and came right back and sat down again. I put up my flannel board again. I started in at Genesis, came down through the story of redemption, God's love for these precious people. When I'd finished and I had no more voice left, about 3 hours later, I said, all right, go home now and cook those potatoes and then come on back and I'll teach you some more. They went off on a run, they cooked the potatoes and came right back and sat again. And that afternoon, we had rain. And I can remember getting everybody into that little house that could get on that floor, and you get a lot of people in because they squat and have their knees drawn up against them. And that house was full, and there were 3 tiers of heads in the window. And on beyond them, standing in the rain, I could see men with their ears like this, trying to hear what I was telling them of the love of God. When I finally lost my voice, I said, all right, go home, feed your pigs, eat your potatoes, and come back, and I'll tell you some more. They went off on a run, fed the pigs, ate the potatoes, right back they came again. 10:30 that night, I lost my voice again. I said, go home and sleep. Tomorrow morning, I'll teach you some more. When I woke up the next morning, there they sat outside. I said to the old chieftain, the witch doctor, I said, why did you send for us? He said, you know, he said, we learned through those nights that the God that you came to tell us of was real. Then he said, we saw what God did in the life of one of our young men. And a young man that I had led to the Lord, and I didn't even know it. You don't have to tell people to give their testimony, teaching them something by rote. If it's real, it's there. It's like a great swelling of joy within you. You've got to tell somebody else. I didn't know it. Every week he'd gone up there, and he'd told them everything he'd heard me tell during that week about Jesus Christ. And then he would come back again. He was in the school, and the next week, there he was. He was gone again. I didn't know where he was going. But then this head witch doctor sent word down, and he said, anyone that can make the change and transformation in the life of a young man that Jesus made in the life of Yomai, it's something we all need to know about. And that man stood there that morning when I finally had to leave because we had to make preparations to come home on furlough. He said, now we steal. But he said, I want to say this to you. He said, don't anybody touch anything on that house or inside of the house, because if you do, maybe Mama Horosi and Horosi Rose won't come back anymore and tell us about Jesus. We got word recently from a missionary who visited the area. He said that house is being protected. Nobody has touched a thing. They're waiting for you to come back and tell them about Jesus. Listen, young people, do you think there are no more worlds to conquer? You think there are no more lost tribes? I'd just like to take you out to New Guinea. I'd like to have you stand on the mountaintop with me. Look down into those valleys like great fingers stretching out below you and know that no person has ever been in those valleys to tell those people that Jesus died. And right on across the highlands, there are still thousands of people who had never heard the name of Jesus Christ. Is it nothing to you, all ye that pass by? Behold and see if there be any sorrow like unto the sorrows of my people. Young people, these are days of preparation. Everything God's bringing into your life is in preparation for the days that lie ahead of you. And when the heathen world looks down on your life as you move in among them, I want you to be able to say, my God is able, abundantly able. Be anxious for nothing. Don't worry about a thing, he whispers to your heart this morning. Wherever he takes you, he'll enable you to do the task and do it well and do it triumphantly. For he never asks anybody to do anything that he doesn't equip you to do it and do it well for God's glory. Don't worry about a thing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. May the day come, if he tarry, when some of you will be out there demonstrating the gospel to men and women that now sit in darkness and in the shadow of death.